evening, everybody. Welcome. May we completely realize the Buddha's true teaching. This is a Zen center, and the teaching of Zen is about the teaching of just this, being present right here, right now, just as it is. But it emerges from a Buddha world. You know, all of the teachings in the Buddhist tradition have a lot of teachings, and the teachings are all skillful means. They're thoughts that turn the mind toward the present moment. And all of the teachings also help us recognize what gets in the way of being able to be completely present. So the first of the teachings was the Four Noble Truths. And the first truth is the truth of difficulties, that when we're human beings and we have consciousness, we have troubles. We have troubles because things aren't the way we want them to be, or the way we expect them to be, according to our ideas and our habits and our customs. The second of the Noble Truths is that that these problems and suffering come from clinging to our ideas and our notions and our habits and our past experience and all the things that we cling to and hold on to and expect to be true going forward, right? Personal attachments and also attachments to behaviors and attitudes and everything else. So one of our practices, of course, is to become more and more aware of what catches us. Then the third noble truth is there is a path. There's a way, there's the possibility for human beings with consciousness that can be troublemaking to also be clarifying. And there is a way to clarify. And that way is the noble, the Eightfold Path. So the Eightfold Path describes kind of basic components of a human life and energy and way of the mind works. So I wanted tonight to talk about the Eightfold Path. This is all in the context of thinking about being free to be at ease. If we live according to the guidance of this path, we can drop the mind of suffering and separation and be really fully at ease. So what the Buddha said about that is one of the many things he said. Now I am frail, Ananda, old, aged, far gone in years. This is my 80th year and my life is spent. Even as an old cart is held together with much difficulty, so the body of the Tathagata is the awakened one, is kept going with supports. It is only, Ananda, when the Tathagata, ceasing to attend to any outward thing, becomes plunged in that devout meditation of heart which is concerned with no bodily object. It is only then that the body of the Tathagata is at ease. So there's a really central teaching about meditation, that becoming aware, being able to relax enough and settle and not get trapped in the creations of the mind, of the cognitive processes and preferences and all of that, we can become plunged in a devout meditation of heart, which is concerned with no bodily object. So if we are not concerned with the body of thought, the body of the senses, what is it that is objectless in our awareness? This is a really direct pointing teaching. So he gives us the Noble Eightfold Path to help us get to that quiet enough to be able to recognize that aspect of mind and heart that is not dependent on the body, has no bodily object, is free of concerns, of the usual concerns that lead to pain and suffering and a desire to separate from that. So this is, you know, simply put, I like to think of it as we have awareness. We can populate the awareness with thought and all the different kinds of thoughts that we have. Planning, remembering, scheming, criticizing, just everything. Or we can recognize how to absorb instead into pure awareness, awareness itself. To recognize that it's always right here. It's very, very obvious. But as long as we're very habituated to identifying with all of the content of our thought, we might miss the fact that we have this awareness that is vast, has no, is never separate from anything, and has no edges. And with that awareness, we can then very minutely appreciate cause and effect, karma. I mean, we can see clearly what's actually going on in form, what's coming into form and what's passing out of form continually, interdependently. So the first of the right paths, and when he says right, it means true, rather than right as opposed to wrong. We never say right and wrong. We don't. You know, one of the teachings is freeing ourselves from the bind of opposites. And so when we say right view, we say a view that is liberating, a liberating view. And right view is appreciation, kind of seeing with the eye and heart of impermanence, interdependent arising, and the emptiness of any fixity of self. Anything, any permanent selfness. So right view is points also to, instead of the there being an underlying self-substance, which some people call the soul, which passes from one incarnation to the next, every individual is compounded of the five skandhas. This is the one of the earlier teachings. The five skandhas are form, sensation, perceptions, mental activity, or formations, and consciousness. That's all it is. That's all any mind moment is constructed of. And these aspects, these skandhas, are always in flux. So a right view clears one's path from confusion, misunderstanding, and deluded thinking. If we find ourselves clinging to some fear, it's all about what we don't want to happen or what we do want to happen, right? Something having to do with the self as opposed to non-self. So it's always based in a dualistic view. So this right view says nothing can be expressed in fixed conceptual terms or rigid dogmatic concepts. We become aware of our points of view as we practice. And this releases us from the cycle of birth and death, the cycle of becoming and dissolution. So a human life, the life that has a name, a biography, a birthday, has a beginning and an end, and is bounded in time. But this Buddha nature is not. It kind of taps into the continuity of all time, all being, that is not separated into a specific form that begins and ends. Then there's the second, so that's right view. And I'm going through this very quickly. But actually our practice is all about this all the time. Also all about all the time is right resolve. So each of these things includes everything when you really delve into it. Right resolve or right intention is based in the renunciation of ill will and affirms harmlessness and the benefiting of all life, which is really the bodhisattva vow, isn't it? Right intention. And right intention to abide in awareness of interdependence, impermanence, and no self. So keep that ever in mind. Impermanence. We can constantly watch it unfold. Interdependence. When we give it a moment's thought, everything is interdependently arising. I'm speaking, you're hearing. You know, you're hearing, you're having a thought, you're having a reaction. I'm speaking, you're speaking in your heads. So working with this means that we practice and remember that as people of the way, and when I say people of the way, I'm talking about capital way, the Tao, people who live in the present moment, who are awake to the present, live according to vow. This right intention is to realize fully our Buddha nature, our deepest, most essential nature, and live according to that, as opposed to living or aspiring in the direction of living according to our suffering nature, which is also, we all have. That's our human nature, suffering nature. I think it's kind of interesting that this teaching, if you look at the teaching of this Buddha teaching and Christian teaching, Christ is kind of the embodiment, the archetype of the human being, suffering, isn't it? And that's also kind of the bodhisattva way, suffering on behalf of all beings, to save all beings. But we look into the source of that. And this vow is to not leave any aspect of our life out of our awareness, to really pay attention to how everything is continually emerging newly and is open. It's open. This recognition that everything actually is always open leads to don't know mind. We may think from past experience that we know somebody or we know that certain things going to happen. And yeah, sometimes, often, it does, exactly so, but not always. Because we cannot know what we don't know. Mostly everything is out of our awareness, and everything is conditioning what comes forward. So right now, we live in a massively don't-know time. We really don't know. We try to predict, but we don't know. The next is right speech. So there are some, whenever we say right speech, we're talking about how do we speak in a way that continues to help us be awake to our deepest nature, the deepest nature of all things. Well, we try to stay factual, helpful, kind, pleasant, and timely. Not always possible, and not always do we do that. We fall into lying, or not quite, but almost fudging, You know, fudging is fairly regularly we fudge. We exaggerate, for instance. Divisive speech is not right speech. Divisive speech that causes, that is deceiving in some way, that is divides people, divides humans from the earth, from animals, from each other. Or abusive speech. Right speech delights in creating concord and peace, peaceable co-living. Right speech is affectionate and polite and pleasing. Right speech, oh, so when we're practicing with this, we refrain from idle chatter and gossip, which can be really problematic. Once we, it's like an imp being released into the atmosphere. You never know where it's going to land. Even with good intention, we just don't, we don't know. And also speaking in a way that is connected to the goal of liberation, connected, that emanates from our vow. We keep our vow in mind to act as if we are already fully awakened. And so we pay attention to these, you know, whether what we're saying is helpful, whether it's kind, whether it's true, and whether it's timely. Then there's right action, which is, we are really helped by precepts with right action. And right, there's no absoluteness to right action. It just depends on the circumstances. But there are certain aspirations. Most of the precepts are impossible to keep, but they keep the concern for our effects on all living beings in mind. So abstaining from killing, taking life of any sentient being, which includes human beings, animals, birds, insects. The Buddha excluded plants because they're not considered sentient beings, but we know that orange groves in Florida that are where they put speakers in the fields and play Mozart grow glorious fruit. So they are sentient. Plants are definitely sentient. If you were a plant person, you know that. It reacts and responds. And then we abstain from stealing or intentionally taking what's not voluntarily offered, respecting the property of others. That includes also relationships, not coming between people who are in relation, who are in beneficial, committed relationships. And then Bhikkhu Bodhi specifies also that not stealing by stealth, by force, by fraud, or by deceit. And then also abstaining from sexual misconduct. So being faithful in relationships. So those are, that's all under the heading of right action. Then there's right livelihood. Not possessing more than is strictly necessary is part of right livelihood. So when we do eating practice in Buddhist circles, we do orioke, which means just enough. So that's not just eating just enough, but consuming just enough. We could say that this modern civilization is dying from consumption. And that's very much what right livelihood is all about. But also it means avoiding causing suffering by cheating or harming or killing them, not trading in weapons, not eating meat or alcoholic drinks or poison. And that is not always, that is not absolutist, but these are things just to keep in mind. And then right effort is striving to eliminate unwholesome mental states and to generate wholesome mental states. So that's really about our choices in what we fill our senses with and our hearts. We take good care of the body to maximize our life energy, to free it up, to use on behalf of all beings. We study to develop, increase, and cultivate knowledge that can be used and skills that are useful to improve people's life circumstances. This is called right effort. And we also look at the hindrances to right effort, so becoming aware of sensual thoughts and how they can cloud our judgment. Doubts about the path, skeptical doubt is one of the hindrances. Thinking that you're not capable of really being your best self, basically, your most expansive self. Restlessness, drowsiness, or ill will of any kind. So these are all hindrances, and it's not that they don't come up, and these we don't criticize these, but we become aware of them when they come up and recognize how they influence our own suffering or peaceful state, and how they influence our actions that affect others. Then there's right mindfulness. Not to crave and cling to any transitory state or thing. Maintaining awareness that phenomena are impermanent and without self and interdependently arising. Right mindfulness is not just paying attention. Paying attention is part of it, but more importantly, it's remembering our vow. It's remembering to be present, just like when we're meditating. And then we fall off into thinking, and we think, oh no, back to this present moment, back to this breath. Back to penetrating deeply into that which is of no bodily portion. And then right concentration, which is the all of the first seven of these allow us to practice right concentration, which is samadhi. So that's really being able to be calm and concentrated enough that we can become deeply absorbed in the present. Deeply absorbed in the present with the widest possible view to see into our nature. This is not, it's mystical, it's considered mystical because it's direct. But it's not, and it's mysterious because all of life is mysterious. You know, where did all of this come from? But it's also very, very ordinary. We all have access to the complete life at every moment. So the Noble Eightfold Path is a description of what we practice with in order to be fully awake to this life and use it well. To end the suffering of living according to a delusion. And, you know, we look around in the world and William Stafford said, the darkness around us is deep. And within us is deep. And we can... there is a path. We can wake up. So that's the import of the Noble Eightfold Path. To remember there is a path. And it's very important also to know that waking up doesn't spare us the difficulties of the conditioned life. We all die. You know, we can die. Some of us are fortunate to die not in pain. Some die in tremendous pain. We all lose loved ones and have tremendous grief. That's part of it too. But we can know the nature of it, and then it changes. And it's universal, and it's a timeless experience that has, in some odd way, a sense of joy, the joy of completion when it's that big. So when we come together to sit, it's a really momentous affirmation of our ability to wake up, and we'll help each other with it. So let's continue to do that.